So where do those car keys go? They just seem to evaporate. And Lloyd is right. They always show up again. Well, we'll talk about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Lloyd, I was half kidding when I started. Now I'm serious. Where do those keys go?
Well, you know, a colleague of mine by the name of Julian Isaacs many years ago, I think he's the one who coined this, he did a lot of research on psychokinesis, on mind over matter, and he coined the term JOTT, J-O-T-T, to cover those situations where apparently our minds seem to move things and then move them back for whatever reason. JOTT, of course, stands for just one of those things. A little bit of sense of humor there. But the idea is that there's two things here, a couple things here. First of all, when we put things down, we have a memory of where we put them. Sometimes our memory does play tricks on us. Our perceptions play tricks on us for whatever reason. And it could be that our unconscious does not want us to see the keys for whatever reason. There may be some awareness of a need.
Even though they're right there.
Even though they're right near. You know, we talk about hallucinations of seeing things that there are not there. We see things that are not there.
Mm-hmm.
There is a negative hallucination where you don't see things that are in fact there. Now,
like a mirage.
Right. But here's the thing. You got three or four people looking for your keys, and unless they're screwing around with you, there's something else going on. And there are times, it seems, that we put things down and they get moved on, our unconscious may move them. Think of it as a mini poltergeist event for whatever reason. Maybe just we shouldn't be going out at this moment. And 5 minutes later, we can go out. So there's something else going on there that's related to the unconscious. And it, either whether it's a negative hallucination or it's actual psychokinesis, it's still, there's probably a reason why this is happening. It also could be just stress that we're screwing around with ourselves in that sense.
Yeah, but, you know, it's happened to me, Lloyd, several times. And I know, for example, that I put them right here, let's say, on the counter. I know that. It's a routine. I do. I'm a creature of habit. And, you know, 5 minutes later, you go back and they're not there. And then 5 minutes later, you come back again after searching all over the place.
And they are there.
They're exactly right where you thought they were. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah, it is bizarre. And it's part of that unconscious thing that goes on that we're not even aware of. You know, when we talk about poltergeist phenomena, we can talk about the bigger cases where things break and fly. But in reality, when you are in a really stressed out situation and your computer acts in ways that really shouldn't, unless it's Windows, of course, or if other electronics around you, you really start messing up, including, I mean, I've seen situations where things have been on when they were not plugged in because of people being stressed out, myself included. So we have the ability unconsciously to affect things around us, whether it's electronics or other physical things. And this is just one more element or one more example of it.
This is affecting ufology, these incredible computer-generated pictures of UFOs that even experts have a difficult time, you know, telling themselves this isn't real. What about in the field of ghost investigations? Are people playing around with their computer in Photoshop and coming up with images that look so darn right authentic and they're not?
Well, you know, honestly, I don't think people are doing it that much because the photos that we're seeing are not what you'd expect. They're the orb-type pictures that which come from reflections. They're not of necessarily full figures. In fact, I almost never see full-figure-type pictures. Somebody showed me one, and I was suspicious that it was Photoshop in that sense. But there are most people kind of sending in pictures to me, and like you get all the EVPs, I get all the pictures, and please don't send me pictures, folks. Please don't send them to me. We look at these pictures, and there are all sorts of photographic potentials for why the round light shapes or swirly things appear on them that don't rely on Photoshop at all. They don't need to in that sense.
Yeah, but... Have you ever seen a great ghost photo that you believe was darn real?
I have seen a couple of photos which were taken at the same time that people were having an experience. And it's that correspondence between the experience and the camera and the picture that makes that picture more valid to me. Just like I have gotten extremely unusual electromagnetic readings when people were seeing or talking to the ghost but not at other times. So in this case, the picture, the camera itself, is a detection device that supports the human experience. There's no way to look at a picture and say that's a ghost. You know, unlike a UFO, if you got nuts and bolts hardware, theoretically, at least by by some people's perspective, there's something that's actually reflecting light. But with ghosts, we're not dealing with things that are reflecting light. We're dealing with mental phenomena. In other words, you got a free-floating mind out there, kind of like some of the aliens in Star Trek that were disembodied entities that could project an image into the minds of the people around them. And so we have nothing that's actually reflecting light, unlike a potential nuts and bolts hardware that might reflect light. So it's a very different circumstance to say that we have a picture of a ghost than to say we have a picture of something like some craft.
You know, Lloyd, I get a lot of interesting phone calls from people, and sometimes the orb phone calls are bizarre because people talk about, you know, balls of light. And sometimes you think, you know, maybe it's plasma,
right.
Maybe it's Earth-related.
Yeah.
But, I mean, sometimes they seem to have intelligence behind them. Specifically, also, crop circles, crop formations. Mm-hmm. A lot of people see orbs out in the fields.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Well, you know, here's the question. Are orbs ghosts?
Who knows?
Well, that's an important question. If we have people actually seeing the orbs as opposed to just pictures after the fact, which is what most of them are, that's a different circumstance. And they may be, I mean, it could be anything from something other dimensional to a ghost to another life form. I mean, there's any number of explanations that we could speculate about.
I was going to say, what if they're like floating jellyfish or something?
Right. There's a lot of different possibilities, but this conclusion, the illogical leap that a lot of ghost hunters made over 10 years ago that this orb must be a ghost, it's extremely illogical. Because they were making those leaps based on pictures, rather taken at places that had never had phenomena. In other words, people had not reported ghosts. So I don't know where the connection was to ghosts.
Is the internet help or hurt your field?
Oh, it certainly hurts in many, many, many ways.
How so?
Well, there's just so much bad information out there. There are people who are putting up, you know, their supposed credentials. I mean, it's amazing to me how many people claim to have certificates or certifications as ghost hunters, parapsychologists, paranormal investigators. I actually had somebody send me an email recently saying that they were certified as a paranormal psychologist, and yet they had no background in psychology.
Maybe they're just certifiable.
Well, there may be that. I suggest that they not call themselves a paranormal psychologist because the laws in the states are that you can't do that. That person would end up in jail potentially.
You're kidding me.
There's a law. I mean, certainly fine. If anybody complained to the state board of behavioral services, whatever it is in each state,
right?
You can't call yourself a psychologist unless you fill certain criteria. And you can't be certified as a psychologist. You can be licensed, but you have to have certain academic background for that.
True. Now, my aunt was a psychologist, a doctor. She's passed on. She was into ESP in a big way, Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a big way. And she was one of the first researchers who studied this, 40-some years ago. I've always wondered what it would be like had she continued on her research. She might have been able to bust through this in a scientific way. But there's not a lot of hard evidence out there. And that's the difficult part for you, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of hard evidence of ghosts, poltergeists, and things like that, because we're talking about witness testimony for the most part. There is certainly hard evidence in the laboratory for other psychic phenomena, but so far we've not had a lot of luck getting a ghost to get into the laboratory.
How much of this is faith? Faith that the other side exists?
Oh, a lot of it.
Yeah.
I mean,
faith that when we die, we pass on.
Yeah, there's no question that there's, I mean, this is a fundamental belief system that people have, just like people had a fundamental belief system that the world was flat, and then they have a fundamental belief system today that the world is round. We have a worldview, and for some people, the worldview is there's just no way that I'm going to die. I mean, there's some continuation afterwards, and these experiences may very well be an indication of that. There's evidence, of course, the reincarnation cases, especially those that have been investigated by the University of Virginia for over 50 years, with little kids under age 4 who recall past lives sometimes in a way that can be verified, and you can verify that they have no way of knowing this information about these people that they claim to have been. You know, there's indications in many areas that there is some continuation of consciousness, but the big question is, what is consciousness? We still don't have that one nailed down.
Are you convinced, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the other side exists?
I'm convinced that there's some continuation of consciousness. I just don't know. You know, I don't know if it's another side. It may be here. It may be some other, you know, you were talking about a multiverse before. We know that we live in a world of four dimensions that we are aware of. And, of course, there are other dimensions that are mathematically described. So it may be that there's some dimensionality, as you mentioned, once you become energy, once you're only consciousness. So it's kind of hard to say exactly what's going on because we still don't have a handle on that question of what consciousness is.
How many investigations do you go out on, Lloyd, on any given time?
Once a month?
It varies
from month to month, but usually these days I kind of pick and choose the cases I go out on very carefully. I send other folks out on them in other parts of the country. I get a lot of calls from all over the country. So I go out on a couple of investigations every month. You know, an investigation to me is actually people to talk to and phenomena to investigate as opposed to walking into a spooky old building to see if there's anything there. So I mean, if I wanted to do that, I could do something every day. But
have you seen techniques change over the years? Are you changing anything to make things easier or better?
Well, the things we've seen change over the last, especially the last 25 years, has been the availability of environmental sensing equipment has made things really interesting because we can connect magnetic fields and other types of environmental changes to people's experiences. In fact, parapsychologists and folks in and around the field have figured out certain non-psychic explanations for some of the ghostly phenomena. So, for example, in some cases, high magnetic fields can cause people to have hallucinations. In some cases, low-frequency sound can cause you to see shadows out of the corner of your eyes or feel anxious. So we look for these environmental conditions that might cause you to come to the conclusion that there is a ghost when, in fact, there is not. So we've learned a lot about what affects the human mind and the brain and the body in ways that we can eliminate non-psychic potential or non-paranormal incidences to really focus on what might really be the paranormal heart of the matter. And that's been a real shift especially over the last 25 years.
Have you investigated or talked with people who claim to see shadow people?
I've talked to a few. You know, the problem is that most people I get are people who have these shadows out of the corners of their eyes. And there's a different category here, which I'll get to in a second.
But don't we all have that?
We do from time to time, but, you know, we can sometimes detect that there is a low-frequency sound wave, a standing wave that actually affects people that way. Now, there's also the possibility, you know, we talk about a ghost. We talk about a consciousness, a mind, that is projecting into your head what they look like, what they believe they look like. I mean, it's a self-image. So people often look better after they're dead than they did when they were alive, unlike the movie The Sixth Sense, because we all have a positive self-image, or most of us have a very specific self-image of ourselves. There's a reason why ghosts are not seen without clothing, and that's because most people don't think of themselves without clothing. So it may be that in some cases the shadow people are not shadows per se, but they're not fully formed images. In other words, it's just a partial impression of a person standing there, but not all that information that says what they look like.
Why in the heck, though, Lloyd, do people see these things with hats on, for example? And I'm not kidding.
Well,
a lot of people see these top hats and things.
When I go and do lectures at colleges, one of the things I do is all my classes, I like to ask the folks who are in attendance to close their eyes and picture themselves. Get a nice picture of yourself. And open their eyes. Now, aside from the one frat guy in the back who's drunk, everybody pictures themselves with clothing on. And it's whatever clothing they tend to wear. So if somebody's wearing a hat, it's likely that that person is a person who thinks of themselves wearing a hat. It could be a baseball cap.
No, these are high top hats. These are the old top hats.
Whoever those people are, there may be a bunch of the of 1940s ghosts running around who are missing out on some high society event.
Yeah, they're like Abe Lincoln hats, you know, those kind of hats.
Yeah, I've not heard of cases, you know, one or two cases over the years like that, but generally most of the ghosts look a little bit more modern.
Okay, how many of these ghostly stories can be explained naturally? Most of them?
Well, I think when we get calls, we can probably dismiss a large percentage of the cases of the calls just based on what's being described, either because it was a one-time experience that we can't investigate per se, but generally because there are other circumstances we can often interview about that would lead us to think that there's some natural explanation for them.
Or the person may be off a little bit? Is that possible?
You know, it's actually easier to tell that most of the time. Drunk is harder. I mean, in other words, somebody's an alcoholic and they're making something up. When people actually just make something up out of their minds rather than believing in it,
right.
It tends to have more of a ring of truth. But when people are really in a reality of their own, the more they get into describing what's going on, the more it's clear that there's some other disturbance, psychological disturbance going on. So we can kind of pull that aside quite a bit. But we've even had cases where, you know, one family member called for another, and when we get there, it turns out that the family member who made the call was humoring the one person in the house. And so we have to kind of deal with the psychological perspective at that point.
Sure. And you've heard, too, when you talk about made the call, people who have had their dearly departed ones call them at the moment of death. Now, that's strange, too.
Yeah, you know, there was a book that came out many, many years ago called Phone Calls from the Dead. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayless. Out of print, but there are these kinds of cases where people have used technology to communicate are not unusual. The big question is whether or not the phone actually did ring, and whether there was actually a voice, or whether this was simply a mode of communication. In other words, did that ghost just simply put the thought in your head, or was there an actual sound across the phone line? And there's no way to know that, especially after the fact. Either way, it's a communication, and that's the most important thing.
And now with caller ID, people see ones across the...
Yeah, so if they're getting something on caller ID, then there's clearly something going on with the actual phone itself.
You remember the little boy in Twilight Zone who would talk to his grandmother?
Yeah.
His dead grandmother, the phone would ring and he'd pick it up and chat with her?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sure do. I mean, the idea of communication through technology, through any means of... Well, there's all sorts of communication that went on well before the age of electronics. And almost every possible form of communication seemed to have sometimes some element of conversation with the other side.
Do you ever see the day where real science will jump on board with what you've been doing and help solve this dilemma and maybe say we record these incredible magnetic pulses? Ghosts are real, they're energy. Do you think that'll ever happen?
I think it will. I think we're getting closer and closer to some things happening because of what's going on in physics today, especially with quantum entanglement experiments. The idea that particles together, separated now, can communicate somehow information across distances instantaneously. That's an indication of something about ESP and something about non-local consciousness. And we're kind of starting to get some idea. And because physicists are getting interested in consciousness as a thing as opposed to just a mechanism of neurons, I think we're going to start seeing more work in physics that is applicable to parapsychology and more in parapsychology that is working towards that end in physics. So I think there may be a coming together where parapsychology really is consciousness studies in some respects, and certainly studying a dead person's consciousness falls into that as well.
Lloyd, when we come back, we'll talk about some of the lab research that's tied into some of these investigations that you go on. What websites and email addresses do you prefer for people to go to?
My main website is mindreader.com, and from there they can get information about the HCH Distance Learning Program in Parapsychological Studies. And also my email is Esper, that's E-S-P-E-R, person with ESP, at california.com is the easiest way. And that you can get to that also from my website, from mindreader.com. Lots of articles there for people to download and some good links as well.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with you and Lloyd. As a matter of fact, you might want to share your ghost stories with us or just your questions of the investigations that he undertakes. We'll be back with him and much more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, tell me a little bit about the lab research and how this ties into what you do.
Well, in general, parapsychology laboratory research gives us a better idea and understanding of how people communicate and therefore gives us an understanding about perhaps how ghosts communicate and how we pick up information from the environment. But there's a couple areas that are really very interesting, one of which is something that Rupert Sheldrake wrote up in his book called The Sense of Being Stared At, but it's the idea of what we call remote staring, that we can set up a controlled laboratory experiment where there's no way that the person being stared at will have any cues that they are being stared at, because it's all done via camera, remotely and controlled by a computer. And yet, not only consciously can people pick out when they're being stared at and when they're not, but unconsciously, by using biometric sensors attached to the skin, looking at skin conductance, looking at heartbeat and other types of things within the body, you can get a change in body state when the person's being stared at and when they're not. And that's kind of an important thing, because we all know that in haunting cases, sometimes we feel like we're being stared at, and that sense is apparently coming from a consciousness somewhere in some instances. The other aspect of biometric sensing in experiments has been connected to precognition, in that there is a new term that we're using called presentiment, which is the idea that we feel things before they happen, as opposed to just simply knowing things consciously before they happen. And again, using biometric sensors, you set up a controlled experiment in which someone is going to be randomly shown pictures of an evocative nature or a neutral nature. So, you know, they could be porn, it could be violent pictures, things are going to get a rise out of you somehow. And they're set up with neutral pictures and then no pictures. And you measure the changes in the body before, during, and after the pictures are shown. And lo and behold, people react a few seconds before the evocative pictures come up. So we actually know a little bit about what's coming before it hits our consciousness.
Well, have they been told, we're going to show you some pictures you may not like to see?
Yeah, well, you have to get a baseline with people, and depending on the experiments, yes, you're going to be shown that, but you're going to be told that kind of thing. In some of the experiments, yes, and some perhaps no.
All right, but what's the basis of doing it this way?
Well, the idea here is to get a sense of whether or not, these pictures are randomly being shown by a computer. In other words, a human being is not saying, here's a picture. They're looking at a monitor, and a picture is going to come up at a random time, and it's going to be randomly selected by a computer system to be neutral or evocative.
Okay.
And so you have reaction or no reaction, and you have to connect that to the image that's being shown. And you can the same kind of thing by telling people, well, you know, we're about to show you a picture that's evocative. And yes, you might get a rise, but as soon as that picture is shown, if it's neutral, there is nothing continuing. So you have kind of the continuation through the actual picture being shown.
But what is this biometric sensory perception, whatever we end up calling it, for sure, what does that tell you about the individual?
Well, what it says is that we, as living beings, get a gut, if you want to call it a gut feeling, we get a sense that something's coming.
We might not know what.
And that's where precognition comes in, is when we know what, we kind of call precognition, or knowing before it happens. But we're having these experiences all the time, and again, in the field investigations, when you take a look at people outside the laboratory, people get unusual feelings quite often what we call gut feelings, and for a reason. I mean, the greatest concentration of nerve ganglia in the body is outside of the brain, is in the gut. It's in our abdominal region.
All right. How would you explain this? And we're going to talk about my dead squirrel story for a moment, but there's a reason for it. 2 weeks ago, I'm in Los Angeles. I'm having a dream of some kind of creature or animal in the bed. And it is so vivid, Lloyd, it felt real.
Mm-hmm.
I wake up out of a dead sleep. I grab what I think is this animal in the bed. I mean, it's really a bizarre, horrible feeling, if you can imagine that, okay? And I love animals, but I mean, whatever I thought this thing was, it's crawling in, I grab it. I'm holding it in my hand, Lloyd, and I just throw it under the bed, okay? I throw it under the bed, and then I kind of come to and I realize, was there a rat in this room? Was there something bizarre here that just happened to me? I turned the lights on. I looked under the bed. It felt so real,
sure.
I thought it was. So I only realized it was only a dream.
Right.
Fast forward, last night, I find this dead squirrel under a bed. How can this be? How can this be?
That would be what I would call a psychic dream, that you were aware, your unconscious became aware of the squirrel under your bed at your house. And it translated that information into the dream itself.
This happens to me all the time.
Well, you know, I did research years ago on psychic dreaming when I was writing a book on the subject, and it's pretty clear that people have very evocative dreams that feel different, that seem different than the other dreams they have, situations like you're talking about that connect to reality. And unlike, you know, a skeptic would say, well, how many other times did you have that kind of dream and there was no squirrel under your bed when you got home? And the answer generally is never.
Well, in the same thing, there is no way I would have connected that first dream and then these 2 weeks go by. I don't think at any point during those 2 weeks, Lloyd, did I think about finding an animal underneath a bed.
Right.
It only dawned on me after the fact. So with this intuitiveness, whatever it is, why can't we know exactly what it is and that it's going to happen? I know some people have this gift.
Well, in the dream state, it's a difficult process because we are not in control of the flow of information in any way. It's our unconscious that's doing that. It's very metaphorical often. Although psychic dreams tend to be more literal. In reality, and when we're conscious, some people are in better control. Like some of the remote viewers were in better control of picking out bits and pieces of information. But it's an analysis process. And the problem is we have our other senses that are sticking all this other garbage in that we're pulling from our normal senses, and it gets all mixed together. And it's a matter of separating out what is the psychic input from the regular input that we're getting. And that's a difficult process.
It sure is. And I wish we could really decipher these feelings. And I guess maybe with practice you can, but I think a lot of people are in the same boat I am, where they get these feelings, but they just don't know when they happen until after the fact. I mean, these 9/11 dreams that people had and feelings.
Yeah, I mean, 9/11 is kind of an interesting thing because a number of people I've spoken to who are psychics actually didn't have anything specific, but they had a very, very difficult time sleeping the night before. I had a really difficult time sleeping. I couldn't go to sleep the night before. I think I fell asleep about an hour before, and then I woke bolt upright when apparently the first plane hit the World Trade Center in New York. I looked at the clock at the same time, as I found out later on. That was a totally unconscious thing. I had no idea what that was about. A lot of people had similar experiences, so there was something going on, I guess you could say something in the force, that we all felt. But it's picking out the specifics that really is difficult because we have so much other information in there that gets in the way.
My daughter, who's pretty intuitive, told me a couple weeks before 9/11, she said, "Dad, I've got this weird dream." And she said, I am dreaming that I'm in this big city. I don't know where I am. And I'm looking up at these tall buildings and all this dust and soot and stuff is coming down on me. And I'm like walking around the streets and it's a foot deep and I can't breathe. And she said, it was a horrible dream. And doggone it, it had to have been a 9/11 dream.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yep.
And I know of someone who actually had a dream months before a plane hitting the World Trade Center and doing what it did. But there was a case back in 1978, a guy named David Booth, who had a recurring
dream. He's been on the program a couple times.
That's somebody who was a very normal guy, had a recurring dream that the FAA took seriously, but didn't have enough information to ground the plane.
Well, he didn't know exactly where it was. They even, I believe it was a DC-10, through his dream, figured out it's going to be a DC-10.
Right.
But they didn't know Chicago. They didn't know where. They didn't know exactly when.
Didn't know what airline.
No, and that thing still haunts him to the day.
You know, I spoke to one of the FAA people years ago who had taken the call, one of the people who had taken the calls from him, and it haunted them too because they just were missing that a couple of pieces of information, and it just was no way to get anything out. They took it very seriously.
What did they say that he told them in his phone call?
As I recall, it was a PR person from the FAA who I got to through an NBC News contact from my dad.
Right. Okay.
And he said that, you know, he described what was wrong with the plane in such detail and what was going to happen when it crashed, you know, when this fault happened, in enough detail, given the fact that he had no background in aviation or in aircraft design, that they took him very seriously.
Because I would guess most people, they would not.
Right. Yeah. That's right. But there was something, what the guy told me was there was something about what he was describing, and when they checked him out, he had no background. There just was something about what he said that just rang too true for them.
And he had like a dozen dreams.
Right.
Over and over and over again.
Right.
Haunting. There's an area of what you do that is starting to grow, and it's really the frightening part of your business, Lloyd, and that is demonology.
Yeah.
Why is it so widespread now?
You know, I think it's widespread because the thrill seekers in the ghost hunting community think it's cool. But in reality, it's not even part of parapsychology. We don't deal with demons, unless you want to call them, you know, the demons from within ourselves, we definitely deal from.
And I've known a lot of people who have those.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they come out in different ways, and we have a lot of things that can haunt us, so to speak, that are from the inside, not even from the outside. And from a parapsychological standpoint, we're dealing with human consciousness. We're not dealing with inhuman consciousness, per se. And to call, you know, when you call things demons, and I met someone who recently who literally called them fallen angels and was coming from the very, very religious Catholic perspective. That is not the same perspective of demons from other cultures around the world. So we just don't deal with them from that point. And the problem is that it's getting completely mixed up with ghost investigations. I mean, ghosts are humans. They're not demons. And people have used the word evil on top of so many of these cases because that's what they think is cool, and that it's the scary movie thing. It's the sitting around in cemeteries and trying to be spooked, which is the majority of folks who are in the ghost hunting community, unfortunately. So it's a very, very cool, scary, spooky thing that has very little resemblance to reality from a parapsychological standpoint. And more importantly, it's scares people. I mean, when you tell people there's a demon in their house and it's got a normal explanation, you know, this is, I think, almost a criminal offense.
Well, but can there be evil spirits in someone's house? Of course there can, right?
Evil, you know, I think it depends on how you determine evil. I think bad is probably a better word than evil. I haven't met too many evil people. There are a few out there in the world, but I haven't met too many of them.
They're out there, Lloyd.
Yeah, I know they are. But, you know,
you've led a sheltered life.
Perhaps. Perhaps. But, you know, in talking to colleagues over the years, a number of us have talked about even just looking at the literature in parapsychology, trying to find, for example, a murderer, a serial killer whose apparition sticks around and haunts people. And we don't find them. We find impressions of the killing. We find recordings of the killing, what we call hauntings or place memory. But we don't find intelligent, conscious entities like that. So maybe they're hiding from parapsychologists. I mean, that's possible.
Or maybe they go straight to hell.
Or maybe they do. But what we do find is people who are argumentative, who are dead, people who are annoyed that you're in their house, people who are mad because you will not pay any attention to them, and their behavior is sometimes like a two-year-old having a temper tantrum. And I wouldn't call that evil. I call it bad behavior, but I wouldn't call it necessarily evil.
If you're in a house, let's say, and I'm not talking about the creaky steps or the squeaky door, and you hear thumping around upstairs. I mean, thumping around. You hear what could be furniture moving.
Sure.
And you realize you're the only person in the house, or you're there with your wife or your girlfriend, and they're with you. What the heck is that?
Well, it could be a couple things. It could be, depending on what was upstairs at any given time, place memory, which could include memory of you, yourself. Let's say that the upstairs at one point, months before, you and your spouse moved the furniture around, and what you're hearing at this point is an echo of that actual movement that you did. It also could be an echo of movement of furniture from the previous inhabitants or even...
Where's that sound coming from? Where's it
emitting? Well, that's the thing, is it's not a sound. I mean, these are not things you can record. These are impressions that you are picking up because we're all a little bit psychic. This is where the magnetic fields come in. We find high magnetic fields typically in cases like this. And they're stationary. They're not moving around like, you know, in some of our apparition cases. And it seems that somehow the environment is holding information that we are capable of retrieving, of picking up. It's kind of like walking into a house and getting a good feel or a bad feel for a place. We get an emotional...
Is it a little like where they say, like, this broadcast now goes out into the universe, and somewhere, someday, a million years from now, someone may have the ability on, you know, planet Zupa to pick up this broadcast. Is it the same thing?
It's the same as that. It's the same as my recording this broadcast and playing it back for myself on an MP3 player. It's a recording. And we've had, I mean, it's probably the scariest kinds of experiences that people have reported to me is when they've seen a ghost, a figure in their home, and it turns out when they get a clear look at the figure is them. Because
that
they're,
is,
they're
that
seeing,
is scary.
You know, they're seeing a picture of themselves. Now, many people have a problem seeing themselves on video. Imagine if you saw yourself as a ghost.
Or in a mirror.
Or
on
a
the
mirror,
side
right.
of her.
Right.
You know, that's another thing, too.
Yeah, so we have that. Now, that could be what's going on. The other thing that could be going on is there could be potentially a conscious entity who is trying to give you the impression of moving furniture, maybe even physically moving the furniture around.
Maybe they want your attention for some reason.
Exactly. Exactly. Or it may not be that at all. It could be something else that's echoing through the house. I had a case years ago where a squirrel pushing nuts across a very rough-hewn attic, the floor of an attic, caused very, very loud footsteps because of the weird acoustics of the building. So you have to kind of look at all natural explanations, too.
And be ready for it. Tell me about these upcoming events that you work on.
Well, besides the HGH classes that we've got, I'm going to be speaking in Fredericksburg, Virginia, at the Ghost Magazine Expo, September 14th through 16th. I will also be at UNIFCON, which is a huge paranormal conference that's being held through Penn State at University Park, Pennsylvania. That's the 18th through the 21st of October. And then the Forever Family Foundation, which is a wonderful organization that helps people who are interested in talking to spirit mediums and kind of continuing on with the idea of communicating with their loved ones. They're having a life after death conference, proof of an afterlife conference, with some major names in parapsychology in San Francisco in January of 2008. And they can find out information about that through foreverfamilyfoundation.org. And then I'll even be at a science fiction convention in Birmingham, Alabama in March.
What's the name of that one?
OmegaCon.
OmegaCon.
Yeah, I love going to science fiction conventions. It's the first time I'm actually going to be able to speak at one, which will be a blast for me.
Well, those are a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I would like to open up the phone lines. We've got one more hour with you, Lloyd. And is there anything specific that you'd like from callers?
Well, questions would be good. I mean, obviously, people are going to call in with their experiences, and I'm happy to talk to
right.
people about it.
And you're going to get questions, but, I mean, are you looking for anything in particular?
Not at this point in time. I don't think in terms of that of specific experiences. I mean, I'd love to hear all sorts of psychic experiences, not just ghostly experiences from people. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really interested in getting the word out is that there are some elements of education available to people these days in parapsychology. So if folks have some specific questions about that, I'd be love to answer those.
All right. Well, we'll have a lot of that available. Your website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. This is, of course, always one of the favorite topics. And you can send me an email if you want as well. That's george@coasttocoastam.com as well. We've still got one more hour to go for you, and we'll take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.